Another day, another chapter. Today we're talking about meiosis and sex and a little bit about genetics. So this is stuff you should have had before, but it's worth reviewing. Meiosis is summarized in slide one, and it's a part of a cell division process that occurs in sexual eukaryotes that sexually reproduce, which is most eukaryotes, including you, of course. And we'll look at the particulars of meiosis in different slides, but meiosis is a nuclear division, just like mitosis is. There are some important differences, of course. Otherwise, we wouldn't bother to call it a different thing. And one major difference is that meiosis involves two rounds of division. And of course, even though we call it meiosis, which specifically refers to division of the nucleus, it's accompanied by cytokinesis as well. So there's two cell division events. And since the first cell division event creates two cells, each of which then undergoes the second cell division, you end up making four cells. And the purpose of meiosis is to produce, eventually, what kind of cells? Gametes. It depends on the species as to actually what we call them. But what are gametes? They are sex cells, right? Sex cells are cells that undergo fertilization, or can undergo fertilization. They can participate in fertilization. In a multicellular sexual species like yourself, you consist of two major categories of cells with respect to cell division types. And those two types of cells are somatic cells, which means cells of the body. Of course, the other ones are part of your body as well, but that's what somatic means. And that's the overwhelming majority of your cells. Almost all of your 10 trillion or so cells are somatic cells. And what is the other category? Not gametes, actually. Cells that can produce gametes. Germline cells, yes. So you have somatic cells and you have germline cells. And the big difference is in what type of cell division takes place in these cells. Somatic cells undergo only mitosis if they undergo cell division at all. And therefore, they only produce copies of themselves when they undergo cell division. Whereas germline cells undergo mitosis first and then meiosis. And so they produce copies of themselves, and some of those copies then undergo meiosis to produce gametes. So germline cells are not gametes. Germline cells can produce gametes by undergoing meiosis. And so since there are two cell division events in meiosis, we split it up over all meiosis into meiosis 1, Roman numeral, and meiosis 2. And the reason there needs to be meiosis is for there to be a reduction in ploidy. What is ploidy? What? Not specific enough. It's not the number of chromosomes. First of all, there's a number of chromosomes total in a cell, which could be N, it could be 2N, it could be 3N, whatever. There's also the number of different kinds of chromosomes, which is also not the ploidy. That's N. Right? N is the number of different kinds of chromosomes. N depends on the species. Ploidy is how many of each of those ends a cell has. All right? So the ploidy is determined by the coefficient of n. 1n, which we just call n, haploid, 2n, diploid, 3n, triploid, and so on. Okay? Meiosis is fundamentally different from mitosis in that it reduces the ploidy, cuts it in half. So a diploid cell enters meiosis, and what emerges are 4 haploid cells, which can then partake in, they can be involved in fertilization, or they might just die as also. All right, let's go to slide 2 and talk about sexual life cycles. Any sexual species has, of course, a sexual life cycle. And regardless of which type, which species you're talking about, or which taxon, any sexual species in its life cycle undergoes a generation to generation alternation between two important processes. So I'm not talking about within the lifetime of the individual. I'm talking about from generation to generation. And what are those two important processes? Well, one is fertilization. That's really the essence of being sexual, right? Being a sexual species means that fertilization occurs as part of your species' life cycle. And what is fertilization? It's the union of two gametes, which are unicellular. Two unicellular gametes fuse or unite to produce one unicellular zygote. So it's kind of an exception to the rule. You know, we're used to thinking of cells splitting to produce two cells. Fertilization fuses two cells to become one cell. All right? And so that one zygote that's produced by fertilization contains the genomes of both of those gametes that united. All right, and this is why sex has its evolutionary advantages, because it creates individuals that are genetically distinct from both parents. It creates new mixtures of DNA, some of which might not be successful, but some of which might just get lucky enough to actually be more fit than either parent is, and might be more fit to a changing environment compared to what the parents were. Anyway, the zygote carries two chromosomes of each type. The zygote is diploid, right? Because it combined the two gametes, genomes. Well, if that were the only process that occurred from generation to generation, then every generation the ploidy would double, because fertilization doubles the ploidy. So generation 1 would be diploid, and then generation 2 would be tetraploid, generation 3 would be octoploid. Well, this can't happen indefinitely, right? It's already amazing that you can cram the amount of DNA and the number of chromosomes you can into not only an invisible cell, but into the smaller nucleus within that invisible cell. So if you keep doubling the amount of DNA, definitely you're not going to be able to keep it in the cell for very many generations. So since there's a doubling of the ploidy in sexual species every generation, there needs to be a mechanism that cuts it back in half so that overall, throughout the generations, you don't actually end up adding more DNA. And that's what meiosis is. That's the second important process that sexual species alternate between. Fertilization, meiosis. Fertilization, meiosis, over and over. Fertilization doubles the ploidy. Meiosis halves it, cuts it in half. So that means the sexual life cycle of a species, not an individual, but from generation to generation, that sexual life cycle will feature a diploid part and a haploid part of the overall cycle. All right? And how much of the time in the cycle is dedicated to the haploid or the diploid depends on the species. Bacteria, of course, they're not sexual, so they don't have they don't change their ploidy, right? They have one of each type of chromosome. They actually have only one chromosome, and they just keep dividing, producing identical copies of themselves. We'll talk about that later. The other three examples here shown, though, are sexual species. These are eukaryotes. And in animals, which we represent, the majority of the life cycle is spent in the diploid stage. We are diploid individuals, right? We're made up of diploid cells. But when we produce our gametes, those gametes are haploid. And you can think about those as their own organisms, right? They are really the haploid generation, which can get together in fertilization to produce another diploid generation, which will grow up as a multicellular adult, right? But there's no multicellular haploid stage in animals. The haploid stage is either an egg or a sperm, and it either dies or they get together, in which case they're no longer haploid. That zygote that they produce in fertilization is diploid, and then that unicellular zygote, which is already diploid, will undergo mitosis to become multicellular and diploid. All right? Just the opposite of that, or the converse, is what most fungi undergo. Their life cycle is dominated by the haploid stage. So an adult fungus, its body is made up of haploid cells rather than diploid, like in us. And so when it's time for it to make its sex cells, it doesn't do that using meiosis because it's already haploid. It doesn't make sense for a haploid cell to enter meiosis. You have to be diploid to enter meiosis because it cuts the ploidy in two, right? So it produces its spores by mitosis. It's already haploid. Mitosis will make cells that have the same ploidy as the original cell, in this case haploid. And so those can grow into adult fungi if they land in the right place that are haploid just like the parent. All right. But it's also true that gametes produced by mitosis in fungi can undergo fertilization. They can get together, producing a diploid zygote just like in us, but unlike in us, that zygote doesn't undergo mitosis to become multicellular and diploid. That zygote will immediately undergo meiosis to become haploid again, and those haploid individuals, which are now genetically distinct from the original one, will grow up to be haploid adult fungi. You see the difference between us and fungi? But it's an alternation between fertilization and meiosis. Plants actually have what's called an alternation of generations because they have a multicellular haploid stage and a multicellular diploid stage. The sporophyte generation and the gametophyte generation. You don't need to know those words, but you should remember those from 182 anyway. So just the different pie charts here of the three with two colors are really just different in with respect to how much time in the cycle is devoted to diploidy versus haploidy. But they all undergo that generation-to-generation alternation between fertilization and meiosis. Okay, in slide 3 we can look at closer detail at meiosis. Meiosis 1, of course, happens first. And importantly, meiosis 1 is when the reduction in ploidy occurs. And meiosis confuses a lot of students. I'm sure you've all learned this before, but usually you have to learn it several times before it actually makes sense. So we're going to spend more time on meiosis 1 because that is really the essence of meiosis. That's where the reduction in ploidy occurs. And the reason that the reduction in employity occurs in meiosis one is that meiosis one is fundamentally different from mitosis, whereas meiosis two really is just mitosis. It's the same thing as mitosis, just happening after you create the first cells that meiosis one creates. All right? What makes it different and what makes it end up causing the reduction in ploidy is that the things that line up during metaphase of meiosis one are different from what line up in mitosis metaphase. Right, there's only one metaphase in mitosis because there's only one stage. But there's a metaphase in meiosis one, there's a metaphase in meiosis two. Metaphase is still a lining up halfway between the poles. But what lines up is different. Before we even get to that, though, let's look at the pictures here and see what's happening. Similar to meiosis, you have a condensing of the chromatin into chromosomes. So you start to see those. Now, this is a diploid cell, which means there's two of every kind of chromosome. There's two N total chromosomes. What is the N of this cartoon cell? What is the value of N? Two. Right. There's how many overall chromosomes? Four. Two N. Diploid means two times N. So if there's two types here, though. A big one and a small one. And there's two big ones, two small ones. A big one from each of the two parents, a small one from each of the two parents. Okay? Now, in mitosis, those four chromosomes wouldn't care what the other three are doing. They would all be independent chromosomes. They're replicated, keep in mind, as well. They're replicated just like they are in mitosis because they've already gone through the S phase of the cell cycle. So each one of them is two chromatids, sister chromatids, stuck together at a centromere. All right? But there are two number ones and there are two number twos. In mitosis, the two number ones wouldn't care where the other one is, and the two number twos wouldn't care where the other one is. There would be four replicated chromosomes that line up in metaphase. But in meiosis, the two number ones do care where each other are. And they find each other. They come together. Now, and the same for the two number twos, of course. The two number ones correspond to each other because they are the same type of chromosome, meaning they're the same size, they have the same genes, just not necessarily the same versions of those genes, right? What do we call variant versions of the same gene? Alleles. So the same kind of chromosome is the same kind of chromosome because it has the same genes located on it. The two number ones are that. They have the same genes, but not necessarily the same alleles for those genes. And so they correspond to each other. We call them homologous for that reason. Each one is a homolog of the other. And so what happens in meiosis one that does not happen in mitosis is that homologs come together. And this coming together of homologs is called synapsis. All right. When synapsis occurs, you're bringing two homologs together, but remember they're replicated chromosomes. So each homolog is carrying two sister chromatids. Therefore, after synapsis, what you have in this homologous pair, which is one way of describing it, is really four chromatids, right? Two pairs of sister chromatids. And there's four things here that will eventually be chromosomes on their own once the splitting has occurred fully. But since there are four chromatids overall in one homologous pair, we can call that homologous pair, other than calling it a homologous pair, a tetrad, which simply means a four-part thing. All right? So synapsis creates tetrads because two homologs will come together. And that occurs in prophase of meiosis one. That's why it looks like you have two things here, but you have what you have two of really are two tetrads, two homologous pairs. You have four overall replicated chromosomes. Okay, now, when it comes time to lining up, and here is the essential difference between meiosis and mitosis. What lines up at metaphase of meiosis one is not individual replicated chromosomes like it is in mitosis. Okay? If this were mitosis, maternal number one, paternal number one, maternal number two, and paternal number two would line up independently of each other. So there would be two N things that would line up, assuming it's a diploid cell we're talking about. All right? Not true in meiosis. In meiosis, what lines up instead of individual replicated chromosomes are tetrads, or homologous pairs of chromosomes. And therefore, N things line up in metaphase of meiosis one. Okay? That's why you have only two things lining up rather than what would be four if this were a mitosis. All right, so since different things line up at metaphase of meiosis one compared to mitosis, different things separate in anaphase one or anaphase of meiosis one compared to mitosis. All right, so what gets separated during anaphase of meiosis one? The homologs that lined up. I mean, the homologs separate from each other. The tetrads split. The two homologs of each tetrad separate from each other. But each homolog, recall, is still a replicated chromosome. So in anaphase of meiosis one, no chromatids separate from each other. The one homolog that separates from the other homolog is still carrying two sister chromatids, and so is the other homolog. That's fundamentally different from mitosis, right? Well, this is why the ploidy splits in two. Because the ploidy is diploid. Now, when the two homologs separate, one cell is going to get one homolog, the other cell is going to get the other homolog. So one cell is going to get N chromosomes, the other one's going to get N chromosomes. That's where haploidy occurs. Does that make sense? Now, it doesn't happen immediately at anaphase because you don't yet have two cells. But that is, once the homologs separate, that's really the essential part where you go from diploidy to haploidy. And once they reach the poles and cytokinesis occurs, now you already have two cells that are haploid. And that's really the goal of meiosis, is to produce haploid cells so that you don't build up DNA over the generations. But we're not done yet because we still have twice as much DNA as we need for one cell, right? Since each of these homologs, which are now in different cells, is replicated, a replicated chromosome. You still have enough DNA for two cells. That's why you need meiosis two. But meiosis two needs to accomplish exactly the same thing that mitosis does, which is to split those two chromatids apart and put them in different cells and call them chromosomes in their own right, only unreplicated chromosomes. And so that's exactly what happens in each of the two daughter cells that meiosis one produces. Those two cells that meiosis one produce are already haploid. Each one then enters meiosis two, in which case we don't even use the word homolog anymore because the other homolog's in a different cell, right? In a haploid cell, it doesn't make sense to talk about homologs because there's only one of each kind of chromosome. So individual replicated chromosomes line up in meiosis two just like they do in mitosis, and the two sister chromatids of each one split in anaphase of meiosis two. So meiosis two is just like mitosis. That'll produce two cells for each of the two that enter it, giving you four overall cells. Those four cells are what develop into the gametes. They are already haploid, and importantly, they are genetically different from each other. They're all genetically distinct. And of course, they're genetically different from the original cell, because for one thing, they're haploid instead of diploid. But it's a rearrangement of DNA that occurs, which is the essence of sex. It mixes up it shuffles the deck genetically. Well, slide 4 summarizes the major differences between meiosis and mitosis. This book uses an additional term. Bivalent is another name. You can call these things homologous pairs, bivalents, tetrads. They all refer to the same thing. But that's the big difference. That's what lines up in meiosis 1. In mitosis, what lines up are individual replicated chromosomes. Now, it's showing here a diploid cell entering mitosis, which of course it can. Any kind of eukaryotic cell can undergo mitosis, but it doesn't have to be a diploid cell. You need a diploid cell to enter meiosis. A diploid or haploid or any ploidy of cell can enter mitosis, though, because mitosis doesn't mess with the ploidy. It just makes two identical copies of whatever cell that was. So a haploid cell entering mitosis produces two haploid cells, just like it does in a fungus that's becoming multicellular, as I said before. Meiosis 2 and mitosis are essentially the same, so it's not even compared in this. The big difference is what's happening in meiosis 1 versus mitosis. Okay, now, usually things go correct. We're on slide 5 now. Things go off without a hitch most of the time, but accidents occur, as you know. And one type of accident is called non-disjunction, which obviously is the opposite of disjunction, right? Disjunction means to separate, or it means separation. To disjoin is to separate. And so disjunction is what normally happens. That's a non-mistake. And that disjunction refers to what happens at anaphase, right? That's when things disjoin. So if something goes wrong in that process, you have non-disjunction. Instead of the two things separating from each other, they don't. And both things go to one cell, and nothing goes to the other cell. All right. Now, this could happen in mitosis as well, but if it happens in mitosis, it's not going to cause anything to happen in the next generation, because mitosis, you know, if it's happening in your somatic cells, those somatic cells are just for your lifetime. You know, they have nothing to do with your offspring. Your offspring are created because of your gametes. So we're more concerned with meiotic non-disjunction than mitotic non-disjunction, because that can be passed on throughout the generations. And so if it happens, then you're going to produce aneuploid gametes. Euploidy, euploidy, refers to the normal number of chromosomes that a cell is supposed to have. Anything other than that normal number is aneuploidy. Remember, EU means true, so anu means not true ploidy. Well, that can happen by non-disjunction, and it can happen either in meiosis 1 or meiosis 2. Either way, you're going to end up with gametes that either have too many or too few chromosomes. Now, too few chromosomes is much harder to survive, right? Because you're missing genes. So those cells just aren't going to be viable. But having too many chromosomes, some cells can survive that. And this can produce viable offspring. They might not actually survive the developmental process, so they might never be born. Depends on which chromosome's involved, but they could be born and just have genetic abnormalities. Like Down syndrome, for instance, is caused by non-disjunction, having an extra chromosome. Now to 6. We're looking at gamete formation in males and females. And for most mammals, it's pretty easy to spot what the male is and what the female is. But what about just in general? Now, if you look at a male marijuana plant versus a female marijuana plant. Well, yeah, you growers might know, but it's not so obvious in certain species. What is it in general that makes the female the female? Well, you don't produce any flowers, so that's not the general definition. No, there's only, not even all mammals use the XY system. Mammals, mammals use XY, but not all animals. And not non-animals as well. Not really. No. Larger size what? Yeah, that's what makes the difference. A female is the member of the species that produces the larger of the gametes. There's a male gamete, there's a female gamete. They're not always called egg and sperm, depends on the group of organisms. But whichever is the larger of the two gametes is produced by what we call the female, and the male produces the smaller gamete. And so in humans, for instance, which use egg and sperm, they're called that, the sperm just need to be, you know, it's good for them to be small because they need to swim a huge distance in terms of their body lengths to get to an egg. The egg, by being big, is making itself maximally viable. By hogging the cytoplasm from the original cell that entered meiosis, it can be as big as possible and therefore survive. But that makes it pretty immobile. So all the sperm really needs to be is a package of DNA that can be delivered to this egg. All right? Therefore, the four things that are created in male meiosis in humans and many other species, those are all equally viable. They're genetically different from each other, like I said, but they're all equally survivable. All right? Whereas in females, there are four things that are produced by meiosis, because there has to be, but three of those things just get discarded, destroyed, recycled for raw materials. Because one of those four will hog as much cytoplasm as possible to be as big as possible so that it can survive well. Because the zygote that's going to be produced, assuming fertilization happens, is really no bigger than the egg itself. The sperm is not donating cytoplasm to the situation. All it's doing is injecting extra DNA. So the egg is already as big as the zygote, basically. And that, therefore, females don't equally partition their cytoplasm into four things, which would have a smaller chance of surviving. They save it for one big thing and discard the other three. All right, now let's review some Mendelian genetics. Named after Gregor Mendel, of course, who figured a bunch of stuff out without any knowledge of the existence of DNA, let alone chromosomes or genes. And even though he was ignored until after his death, he is now known, of course, as the father of genetics, because he figured out that there must be a particulate nature to inheritance, meaning that there is some particle, some discrete entity, which he called a heritable factor, but we now call a gene, that actually gets passed from parent to offspring. Now, for millennia before his time, we had already, of course, recognized that for whatever species, the offspring resemble the parents. And, you know, that this has just been obvious for a long time. But if you think about it, you know, since just using humans as an example, if we say that a child is partially like the father and partially like the mother, which is true, if sex actually were truly blending, then a child or an offspring should be kind of halfway between the male and the female. And if we think about Mendel's example of flower color with pea plants, if you cross a purple-flowered individual with a white-flowered individual and it's truly blending, you wouldn't expect a purple-flowered offspring or a white one, right? You would expect a purplish-white, a less purple, but still purple, right? That's not what happens, though. The offspring looks like one parent fully or the other parent fully. And the reason that is, and the reason that Mendel, it occurred to Mendel, is that it's not truly blending. There is a particle of inheritance that gets passed on as a complete unit. And those particles are the genes. All right? But, of course, there is a dominance and recessivity relationship. Right? First, let's quickly define some things. Characteristic and trait are not the same thing, right? What's the difference? I don't like the phrase makeup. Traits are the possible values of characteristics. Okay, and usually an example just makes it clear. So eye color, for instance. Or let's just use flower color here since we're looking at that. Flower color here is a characteristic. Purple and white are possible traits of that characteristic. So an individual has traits for a characteristic. All right? But there can be multiple traits for any given characteristic. Trait and phenotype are basically the same. Genetically speaking, though, characteristic corresponds to something and trait corresponds to something. What does characteristic correspond to genetically? Gene. Yes. Whereas trait corresponds to what? Allele. Yes. Right? A gene governs or controls a characteristic. But the specific version of that gene you have is what determines whether you have one trait of that characteristic or another trait. Well, those different versions of the same gene are the alleles. So alleles correspond to traits, genes correspond to characteristics. And what we have here is the familiar monohybrid cross. Monohybrid because you're paying attention to one characteristic, in this case flower color, and ignoring all the other characteristics of the plants. It's also a hybrid cross because the two parents are different in their trait for that characteristic, right? So you're all familiar with this. If you do this and produce the F1 generation, the immediate offspring of those two parents, every individual is going to be purple flowered. And that's because purple is dominant over white, right? Mendel noticed this, but then he didn't stop there. He crossed the F1s with each other and noticed that white reemerged in the F2. This is why it's called a recessive trait. Recede means to hide. The white is hiding in the F1 generation, then it reappears. Okay? And the purple dominates. Well, you're all familiar with that. Let's look at why this happens, though, molecularly. Slide 8. So any given cell, any given pea plant, is a diploid individual, first of all. And so its cells have two of every kind of chromosome. We're ignoring almost all the chromosomes, namely the ones that don't have anything to do with the plant color. The flower color. The flower color is controlled by a specific chromosome, a specific gene. And that gene resides on just one chromosome, right? What do we call the place where the gene is on a chromosome? It's locus, right? So, there are two of this kind of chromosome, therefore there are two loci, one on each of those two homologous chromosomes that the plant cell has. And occupying those two loci are the two alleles that the plant has. Right? And so there are, the possibilities are that the two alleles are identical to each other, in which case that plant would be homozygous. And there's two ways that that can happen, right? They can both be the dominant version or they could both be the recessive version. But they're identical to each other if the plant is homozygous. But that's the difference between homozygous dominant, homozygous recessive. The only other possibility is that the two alleles on the two loci of those homologs are different from each other, in which case that plant is heterozygous. Well, in terms of how this affects the trait, remember what I said probably the first day, and I've been saying this several times throughout the term. It's not the DNA that gives you your traits, right? It's the proteins that give you directly your traits. But you don't randomly make proteins. You make proteins by obeying sets of instructions. Those sets of instructions are the genes. So you can only make the proteins that your genes tell you how to make. And in the case of this purple versus white dominance and recessivity relationship, the purpleness of the petal is due to that pigment being produced, right? Well, that pigment is produced as part of a biochemical pathway. Biochemical pathways are, of course, sets of reactions, each of which are catalyzed. And if you don't have the catalyst for one of those steps, the biochemical pathway doesn't operate, and you don't make the end product, which in this case would be the pigment. Well, if one of the genes on this chromosome is the gene that codes for the enzyme, one of the enzymes in the pathway that produces this purple flower, this purple pigment, and the plant is heterozygous for that, it means that one of the genes, one of the alleles, will be the normal wild type, and it will produce the active enzyme, and therefore that will catalyze the step in the pathway that leads to purple production. Everything goes fine. The other one does not produce an enzyme that operates. It's a defective enzyme because of the mutation, and therefore no purple is produced there. But if you're heterozygous, you have some functional enzyme, some non-functional enzyme, and some functional enzyme in a lot of cases is enough, which is why you end up producing flowers that are just as purple as your parent that might have been homozygous purple, right? On the other hand, if you're homozygous recessive, you don't make any active enzymes and the pathway is shut down in all cases, and you end up not putting any purple into the petals, which remain white. So the genetics determine the traits because of the products of that transcription and translation process that occurs at the genes that we're talking about. In 9, we see the familiar Punnett square for the F2 generation of this same exact cross, but now the information that's added is that we're looking at genotypes along the way. And remember that genotypes are sequences of symbols that represent the actual DNA of an individual. So genotypes represent actual alleles or combinations of alleles, whereas phenotypes are phrases that describe the actual traits, right? Like purple or white. Well, the purple parent and the white parent are diploid individuals. Therefore, their genotypes are diploid genotypes, meaning that they will have two symbols for the characteristic in question, in this case, flower color. And that's why the genotype is two P's, either two uppers or two lowers, because this is a monohybrid cross, and therefore each parent is true breeding, meaning homozygous. So upper P, homozygous dominant, lower P, homozygous recessive, right? Well, it's not diploid cells that get together in fertilization, right? It's haploid cells, like we just talked about. So before the next generation is created, the parents have to undergo meiosis, which randomly chooses one of the two chromosomes and therefore one of the two alleles that are carried on those chromosomes for flower color, and therefore the gametes that are produced, the egg and the sperm, have haploid gametes, I mean haploid genotypes, just one P. Well, a true breeding purple flower one has two upper P's, so it doesn't matter which one you randomly choose, you're getting an uppercase P. Similarly for the white, only lowercase. And therefore, that's why there's only one possibility for those offspring. You're going to get an uppercase, lowercase P, a heterozygote individual, in other words. And because of dominance, because we just talked about, or what did we just talked about in the last slide, this thing is going to be fully purple. But when you breed those with each other, now you're crossing a heterozygote with another heterozygote. And therefore, there's four possibilities, right? You can pick an uppercase P in the male, a lowercase P in the female, or any other combination. The Punnett square is just an exhaustive representation of all the possibilities. Right? These are the two gametes that the one parent can make. These are the two gametes that the other parent can make. Getting them together, which represents the fertilization process, gives you the only four possibilities there are. And therefore, that predicts what the phenotypic ratio should be in the offspring. In this case, the familiar 3-to-1 ratio of dominant trait to recessive trait, which is what Mendel actually noticed. Okay, well now we can put together the Punnett square and the genetic knowledge with knowledge about meiosis in slide 10. Sex has the great advantage of shuffling the genetic deck. It produces new combinations of, well, new nucleotide sequences, new stretches of DNA, right, that neither parent had. And there are three sources of additional variation that sexual species have. I say additional variation because there has to already be genetic variation in the population for sex to work. Right? I say it shuffles the deck. That's a good analogy. Well, if you have a deck that's nothing but king of hearts, shuffling it, you can shuffle it for the eternity. You're still going to draw whatever I said. King of heart, did I say? All right? So there has to be differences to begin with for shuffling to matter. What is that original source of genetic variation? Why are there different versions of DNA to begin with that sex can then act on? That's part of sex. Mutation, correct. Mutation, the accidental change in DNA sequences, is what drives all of evolution, but it's what gives the difference in DNA to begin with that sex can then operate on by shuffling the deck and therefore amplify the genetic variation. And so there are three ways in which sex takes that existing variation and amplifies it. Two of those three occur in meiosis. The three, and I'll name them in the order they occur, are crossing over, independent assortment, and random fertilization. Okay? This figure actually shows you what the second one is, which was, as I said, independent assortment. The gray bar here is illustrating independent assortment. Remember that what lines up during metaphase of meiosis one are tetrads, homologous pairs, in other words, or bivalence. Well, every tetrad has directionality to it because there's a maternal homologue and there's a paternal homologue. And so when it lines up halfway between the poles, the maternal homologue is going to face one pole, the paternal is going to face the other pole. Therefore, there's two ways for that one tetrad to line up. Maternal right, paternal left, or the other way around. That's what assortment is, how that thing lines up. Independent assortment says that how one tetrad lines up during metaphase does not at all affect how other ones line up. They all independently assort. So in this simple case where N is 2, the two possibilities are that both tetrads line up with maternal one direction, paternal the other direction, The only other possibility is that you switch one compared to the other one. Okay? Well, if you had n equals 3, for each of these two possibilities, there would be two possibilities for that third one. And so there would be 4 overall possibilities. If you add another one, there would be 8. So there are, in general, 2 raised to the n minus 1 power possible ways for tetrads to line up. Humans have how many different chromosomes? What's our n? 23. Therefore, there are 2 raised to the 22nd power possible ways for tetrads to line up or independently assort, which is about 8 million, I think, somewhere around there. Seems like a high number, and it is a pretty high number, but it's effectively 0 compared to the number of ways that crossing over can occur, which I'm going to have to talk about next time.